So we have our brother Clive with us this morning, and his title for this morning is 1967, Stand Still and See the Salvation of the Lord. He's not asked for the reading, so I'm just going to hand straight over. It's okay.
Good morning, all. My apologies for moving the flowers from the platform, but I could feel my nose tingling, so despite antihistamines, I'm still subject to hay fever. I'm sure you've probably got a feeling of deja vu, because we have been in this place together, collectively, with me speaking on 1967, and I'm hoping that I haven't repeated too much, if hopefully very little at all, from our previous talk on this subject. So, we're going to see how the hand of God works with the nations and indeed with individuals. And that's always provided I can get it to work. So, we remember the words of Jehoshaphat and the prayer that he offered when he said, O Lord God of our fathers, art not thou God in heaven? And rulest not thou over all the kingdoms of the heathen? And in thine hand is there not power and might, so that none is able to withstand thee? So there's the principle that our God rules in the kingdoms of men. And this is demonstrated for us in the life of Sennacherib. Can you turn with me, please, to the second book of Kings? And we know the background, because the Assyrian host, an army of 185,000, is camped outside Jerusalem, and there is absolutely no hope, humanly speaking, for the people of Jerusalem. And there's Sennacherib, nice man that he is, and there's just a few of his 185,000 troops encamped outside Jerusalem. So 2 Kings 20. And verse 31. But out of Jerusalem shall go forth a remnant, and they that escape out of the mount of Zion, the zeal of the Lord hosts shall do this. Therefore thus saith the Lord concerning the king of Assyria. He shall not come into the city, nor shoot an arrow there, nor come before it with shield, nor cast a bank against it. By the way that he came, by the same shall he return, and shall not come into this city, saith the Lord. But I will defend the city to save it, for mine own sake, and for my servant David's sake. And it came to pass that night that the angel of the Lord went out and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they, that is the people of Jerusalem, arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. And we have just an illustration here from an artist. Don't suppose it's very realistic, but there you go. There's the angel of the Lord smiting the Assyrian host of 185,000. So God can actually work with a very blunt hammer when it's necessary for him to do so. But I want to now consider another way in which God works when he's defending his people. Can you turn with me, please, to the first book of Samuel in chapter 28? We're about to see in chapter 29 how David defeats the Amalekites. But firstly, it's interesting, I think, just to look at the fact that Saul has been condemned because he did not destroy the Amalekites. So 1 Samuel 28 and verse 15. And Samuel said to Saul, Why hast thou disquieted me to bring me up? And Saul answered, I am sore distressed, for the Philistines make war against me. And God has departed from me, and answered me no more, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I have called thee, that thou mayest make known unto me what I shall do. Then said Samuel, Wherefore dost thou ask of me, seeing that the Lord has departed from thee, and is become thine enemy? And the Lord hath done to him as he spake by me. For the Lord hath rent the kingdom out of thine hand, and given it to thy neighbour, even to David. Because thou obeyest not the voice of the Lord, nor executest his fierce wrath upon Amalek. Therefore hath the Lord done this thing unto thee this day. And so we move on to the next chapter, where David attempts to get himself involved with the Philistine army. Chapter 29 and verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, and the Israelites pitched by the fountain, which is in Jezreel. So you have these two opposing armies facing one another. And the lords of the Philistines passed by in hundreds and thousands, but David and his men passed in the rearward with Achish. And David clearly had a plan then to disrupt the Philistine armies. But, verse 3, then said the princes of the Philistines, "What do these Hebrews hear?" And Achish said unto the princes of the Philistines, "Is not this David, the servant of Saul, the king of Israel, which hath been with me these days all these years, and hath found no fault in him, since he fell unto me unto this day?" And the princes of the Philistines were wroth with him, and the princes of the Philistines said unto him, "Make this fellow return, that he may go again to his place, which thou hast appointed him. And let him not go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he be an adversary to us, or wherewith should he reconcile himself unto his master? Should he not be with the heads of these men?" And so the Philistines insist that David leaves them, and so he does. And off he goes back to return to Ziklag. Chapter 30 and verse 1. And it came to pass that when David and his men were come to Ziklag on the third day, that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag, and smitten Ziklag, and burned it with fire. So here we see the result of Saul's non-execution of the Amalekites, in that they have now attacked the city of David, Ziklag. And verse 5, and David's two wives were taken captive, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, the wife of Nabal the Carmelite. And so David was greatly distressed, and David then gives chase. Verse 10, but David pursued, he and 400 men, but 200 abode behind, which were so faint that they could not go over the brook Besor. And then we see the hand of God at work. Verse 11, and they found an Egyptian in the field, and brought him to David, and gave him bread, and he did eat, and they made him drink water. And this Egyptian had been with the Amalekites, and he was able to lead David to them. Verse 16, so David now attacks the camp of the Amalekites. And when he had brought him down, behold, they were spread abroad, this is the Amalekites, upon all the earth, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil that they had taken out of the land of the Philistines and out of the land of Judah. And David smote them from twilight even unto the evening of the next day, and there escaped not a man of them, save 400 young men, which rode upon camels and fled. So David had a force of 400 men, and they fought for 24 hours. And presumably it must have been easy pickings for them when they first attacked, as the Amalekites were drunk and carousing. But 24 hours and not a hair on David's head was touched, for he survived. So the angels of the Lord must have encamped around him and his men. So again, we see this principle of God working amongst men to pursue his aim. We now move on then to Israel. It was a very confused picture in the land of Palestine after the First World War. Now, the Arab nations had been ruled by the Ottoman Empire for 400 years. And the Ottoman Empire sided with the Axis powers in the First World War. So there were German troops and Austrian troops fighting with the Ottomans against the French and British forces in Arabia and Palestine. And there you see, if you can just make it out, a German warplane flying over the pyramids in Egypt. Now, what happened obviously was that the Allies won, and the Arabs revolted from the rule of the Ottoman Empire. And we have this enigmatic character, T. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, who coordinated with the British and French forces the Arab revolt. And so the Ottoman Empire was driven out of Palestine and Arabia. Now, what the British and French then did following the end of the world of World War I was to divide up the lands that they had conquered. And what they did was to divide it up as imperial powers. They had no interest in any of the local Arab nations, the kingdoms or the tribes, all of whom had been promised that they would have independence after the war. But the Brits and the French carved it up between them. Now, we often speak of the Arabs as one group, but they were far from this. And I just want to give an illustration. If we look at the demographics of Syria, for example, which obviously gives us an insight into the current situation in Syria. For in Syria, there are Syrian Arabs, there are Palestinian Arabs, there are Kurds, and there were 10% of the population as Christians, though that's probably changed dramatically since, over the last few years. Now, 75% of the Syrian Muslims are Sunnis, the balance are obviously Shias. But even within these two major groupings, there are subdivisions. And one of the subdivisions of the Shias is the Alawites. And President Assad and his family before him are Alawites. So a minority of a minority group rule as despots in Syria currently, which helps to explain some of the issues. But therefore, the French and the British completely ignored these tribal groups, these national groups, religious groups, and political groups in their division of Arab lands. Now, this has caused, over the years, the Arabs to be greatly divided amongst themselves. And even though they are united in their hatred of Israel and their desire to rid the Palestinian land of Israel, they are hopelessly divided. And these are just a few photographs of a conference that took place leading up to the 67 war in Morocco. And it was hosted by King Hassan II. And he couldn't trust his Arab brethren. So what he did was he invited the Israeli Secret Service into the hotel where the conference was to take place. But then he had a change of heart because he realised, obviously, that the Arabs would spot the Israeli Secret Service. So what he did was he taped the whole of the conference and passed all of that information on to Israel. And the result was that Israel, in the lead-up to the 67th war, were fully aware of all the Arab plans, and they were fully aware of the divisions amongst them. And then we have King Hussein of Jordan and President Nasser of Egypt at that conference. So who were the main political leaders in the run-up to 1967 and the war that started in June? There we have Moshe Dayan of Israel, who led the Israeli armed forces and only came into the Israeli cabinet days before the start of the war. There we have Prime Minister Rabin of Israel, Nasser of Egypt that we've spoken of, King Hussein of Jordan, and then we have Field Marshal Amar of Egypt, who was a close associate and friend of Nasser. And he was one of the reasons why Egypt lost the war in Sinai. He was completely and utterly incompetent. And there we have General Uthant, and we'll come on to him in a moment, of General Secretary of the United Nations. And then finally, I forgot this gentleman's name, but it was the president of Syria at the time. So in the lead up to the events that resulted in the 1967 war in June, I just want to highlight some of the events that happened and took place where we clearly see the hand of God at work. In 1956, we know there was this second Arab war, which was related to the Suez Canal and its seizure and nationalisation by President Nasser. And that resulted in Israel conquering the Sinai Peninsula. So what happened then was that the United Nations stepped in and put a peacekeeping force into Sinai as a buffer between Israel and Egypt. And so then in 1966, the Egyptians demanded that the United Nations withdrew from Sinai to remove that buffer. And General Secretary U Thant did that without any authorization whatsoever from the Security Council of the United Nations. So there again, we see the hand of God at work. And then, obviously, tensions started to increase. And between January and March 1967, there were 270 border incidents of terrorist attacks on Israel. Israel then retaliated by hitting Syrian forces in the demilitarized zone between Syria and Israel. And then, in the middle of May, the Soviets, who had supported both Egypt, Syria in their militarization plans, then passed on false information to Egypt, informing them that Israel had mobilized their forces when they had done no such thing. And so tensions increased, and Egypt mobilized its troops and poured 110,000 troops into Sinai. Tensions continued to mount. Now, the Israelis at this time were completely and utterly divided, and they had security cabinet meeting after security cabinet meeting. But they were absolutely petrified at the prospect of striking first because of the reaction of the rest of the world. But as the Egyptian and Syrian forces mobilized, day by day, the tensions increased. And then at the end of May, Jordan signed a mutual defense pact with Egypt, which meant that Jordan was tied in too, fighting alongside Egypt. Then on the 2nd of June, General Dayan, as we've seen there, joined the Israeli cabinet as Minister of Defense. And so on the 5th of June, Israel launched a preemptive strike against Egypt. Now, the situation for Israel, as you can see from that map, before the start of the 67 war, was perilous in the extreme. They had a narrow strip of land between the Jordanian-controlled West Bank and the coast. Tel Aviv was literally 20-25 miles away from Jordan and Jordanian forces. So the first attack by Israel was against Egypt. And it was an aerial attack against the Egyptian Air Force, who were grounded at that time. And again, we see the hand of God at work, because the Israeli attack in the early hours of June the 5th destroyed 300 Egyptian planes on the ground and half of the Syrian Air Force later in the afternoon. And the remarkable thing about that attack was that the Jordanian radar stations that were state-of-the-art at that time, British-built, had picked up the Israeli planes moving across the Mediterranean towards Egypt. But that same day, the Egyptians had changed their codes on their transmissions between Jordan and Egypt. So the message never got through to the Egyptians that the Israeli planes were attacking them. And as I say, 300 out of 400 Egyptian planes were destroyed on the ground. The result of that was that, obviously, as the war progressed over the next few days, that the Israelis had the tremendous benefit of air cover when they attacked. Now, at the time, Israel, on the first day of the war, had no plans to attack either Jordan or Syria. It realised that it had enough on its hands just fighting the Egyptians. It also knew that it had to end the war very, very quickly. It just did not have the resources to sustain a long, drawn-out war. So what happened next on June the 5th? Well, President Nasser, who was absolutely distraught at what had happened, contacted the Jordanians and told them there had been a massive successful attack on the Israeli Air Force. He lied completely and utterly. And as a result, King Hussein of Jordan, who had been reluctant to enter the war, decided that now was the time for him to strike. And Nasser assured him that the planes that the Jordanian radar was now picking up that were coming out of Egypt were not the Israeli planes returning, but they were indeed Egyptian planes attacking Israel. Again, another outright lie. Now, the Israeli defensive position in terms of the Jordanians was such that they were prepared to allow the Jordanians to show some degree of involvement in the war, and the Israelis were prepared to accept some minor skirmishes. But King Hussein, emboldened by what the news was from Egypt, decided on a full frontal attack. The Israelis had absolutely no intention of taking either the West Bank or the old city of Jerusalem at that time. But things moved on, and the Israeli cabinet records show that even though they had no plans to do it and there were no orders to take the West Bank and the old city of Jerusalem, events overtook the political leaders. And so as the Jordanians attacked and the Israelis repulsed them, it just happened to happen, the hand of God at work, that the old city of Jerusalem was taken, and the Jordanian troops just fled from the West Bank. They just disappeared completely and crossed over the River Jordan. So de facto, the Israelis had got both the old city of Jerusalem and the West Bank. So then we turn our attention to Syria. Now, at this point, when the West Bank had been taken and the old city of Jerusalem had been taken, the UN had stepped in and there was a ceasefire between Israel, Jordan and Egypt. But the Syrians refused to join in that ceasefire. And so Moshe Dayan had a window of opportunity because he knew that the Syrians would have to eventually take up the ceasefire. So the Israelis attacked the Golan Heights. And I'm indebted to an anecdote from Sister Christine Thornton. Her father, in his business dealings, had made many trips to Israel pre the 1967 war. And amongst his business contacts was the Israeli Minister of Horticulture. And he was a reservist. And immediately after the war, because Christine's father had lost no opportunity in explaining the position of Israel in the plan and purpose of God to the Israelis he met on his business trips, this Minister of Horticulture, after the Six-Day War, phoned Christine's father and said, "Remarkably, when we were in the Golan Heights, I thought of you and all that you'd ever told me about Israel." Because he said, "Every bullet, every shell that we fired hit a target." And so the Syrians, in complete and utter military chaos, collapsed and fell and accepted the UN ceasefire. So Israel had no wish to take over parts of the Golan Heights. It had no wish to take the old city of Jerusalem or the West Bank. It just happened in the plan and purpose of God as events unfolded. The hand of God at work. There's a timeline which I haven't really spent any time on because time is now running out. But it's a remarkable fact that in 6 days, Israel did all that it did in terms of military gains. There were hundreds of thousands of troops involved in this campaign, but the casualties ran into thousands. So there was very fierce fighting. There was not an enormous amount of bloodshed. And there you see Israelis there at the Temple Mount, which they took over. Now, if I can do this, I've got a 60-second video which gives a very brief insight from BBC News. It's not happening. Quick, Martin. Quick. So the war ended, a ceasefire was declared, the Arabs never ever truly reconciled themselves to the end of the war and the ceasefire, and so they declared the war effectively as just a bad day for them, and that they would continue to fight against Israel. The UN declaration, which I think was 242, demanded that Israel return all of the lands that it had occupied and gained in the Six-Day War. And the Israelis were prepared to do that, provided that the Arab nations recognized them and would grant them peace. The Arab nations refused to do that. We obviously now, 50 years on, see the consequences still showing complete and utter disharmony between the Jews and the Arabs in Palestine. Now these are interesting comments from Prime Minister Rabin after the war. Said that our airmen has struck the enemy's plane so accurately that no one in the world could understand how it was done. But we understand it was the hand of God. Our troops who beat the enemy even when their equipment was inferior, again, the hand of God at work. Our soldiers who overcame our enemies everywhere despite the latter's superior numbers and fortifications. And it's interesting in terms of the Jordanian position that they had been entrenched for 20 years in the old city of Jerusalem and in the West Bank, and their fortifications were very strong indeed. There were trenches and bunkers, but they all melted away before the Israeli forces. He also paid tribute to the coolness and courage in battle of his troops. And he also obviously recognised the fact that the Israeli forces were fighting for their very survival, because the alternative from the Arabs was complete and utter annihilation of Israel. And so Rabin was given the duty to come up with a name for the war. And he called it the Six-Day War, evoking obviously the 6 days of creation in Genesis. But you note amongst those comments that there is absolutely no reference to God whatsoever. But we know differently, don't we, brethren and sisters? We know the hand of God was clearly at work in 1967.